Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to These Football Times Decade Series. We're deep into the 1990s, but we're going to take a brief stop off, focus on another area in the evolution of English football. It was a time when the Premier League was in its infancy, football shirts were baggy, and the battle for the perfect goal scorer was in full swing. I'm Rob Fletcher, and today we're diving deep into one of the most fascinating aspects of English football in the 90s, the strikers, the men tasked with carrying the weight of a nation on their shoulders, from the poaching prowess of Gary Lineker to the rise of Alan Shearer and the emergence of a young Michael Owen. Today we'll relive the highs, the heartbreaks and everything between as England search for the next great number nine. We'll explore England's post-Lineker struggles, the carousel of strikers who lit up the Premier League, will struggle to find a consistent spot in the England squad, the likes of Robbie Fowler, Ian Wright, Les Ferdinand. And trust me, there is a long, long list and we are going to talk about them all. But joining me on this episode is the man behind the supremely successful 80s and 90s football account on the platform formerly known as Twitter, Michael Hamlin. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Hello, Rob. Hello. Really looking forward to this one. We could be here all night. We could be here all night going through these players.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? I sent Michael a bit of an agenda before we came on the podcast a few days ago. And we were talking about there's just too many strikers, isn't there, to list far, far too many.
Yeah, I think I was sort of scribbling around the other day and I've come up with like 35 English strikers. And don't get me wrong, they're not all good by any means, but they all still scored anywhere between sort of 8 and 12 goals a season for their clubs. And you think, wow, you know, look at that now. Where are they? It's definitely an interesting chat.
Some of these strikers probably be about 30 or 40 million in today's market, scoring 12 Premier League goals.
I know. I can't see Graham Stewart and Paul Ridout going for 30, 40 million quid, but they're the sort of names I was coming up with.
Well, you never know with that. With PSR regulations these days, they could go for any kind of money. But we're going to try and start off kind of just talking about the landscape. So obviously a lot of this series that we've done, we've covered all the seasons since 1989-90. So we're kind of looking at the whole decade. But we need to start with really that post-Italia 90 and obviously Bobby Robson leaving England. We're kind of going to frame our discussion around England's international strikers while still talking a little bit about how those strikers were getting on the league, maybe why some of them didn't succeed or some of them did. So we probably, Michael, need to start off with Gary Lineker. And obviously he was made captain by Graham Taylor after Italia 90. He was the leading striker in England for Spurs. He was a leading striker for England. At that point when Taylor takes over, it's still very clear that Lineker is the number one and it's basically who's going to be his partner, isn't it?
Well, very much so. You know, as you said, you know, you alluded to, he was made captain. You know, he was the striker sort of going into Euro 92. It was then who was going to play alongside him. Peter Beardsley was the obvious sort of solution. That's who was playing with him, sort of running up to Italia 90, sort of from Mexico 86 onwards. And then Taylor drops him, sort of tail end of 1990. And then it's then, who does he play alongside him? And, you know, Lineker was a fantastic striker, but he always seemed to like playing with a player who liked to be a bit sort of deep-lying, sort of takes defenders forward, creates space from in behind. Didn't, you know, the famous thing was Peter Beardsley wouldn't be in the box and Lineker would be in the box. And, you know, now he's got a situation where he's playing with someone else. So, you know, the players that Taylor sort of chooses in no sort of chronological order, you know, he picks sort of David Hurst. You know, I think David Hurst was probably the player that would or should have taken over from Lineker until he obviously gets his broken ankle against Arsenal, which really sort of ruins his career sort of going on throughout to the 90s and sort of knocks him out. But, you know, Brian Dean gets a try for a couple of games. You know, Alan Smith, I know he was around before Italia 19, didn't go. But, you know, he was another player, again, similar mould to Beardsley in the sense he was, I say similar mould, that's not true, but a target man, not necessarily a goal that's going to score you 25, 30 goals, although, to be fair, Alan Smith did get quite a few goals. But he tried players like Paul Stewart from, you know, the Tottenham, you know, when he went to Liverpool, Nigel Clough, you know, looking for a combination. You know, Ian Wright came in sort of 91, and none of them really worked.
And I think the problem for England was, and the problem for Lineker was, it didn't really suit his style. I know you could say, you know, he did Alan Smith partner him, I think, at Leicester, didn't he? In the, what, the early 80s, I think it was, wasn't it? And I think maybe at the time that worked for a young Lineker, you know, when he was absolutely rapid and he's running behind defenders. He wasn't that type of striker at this point. He was more, like you say, worked around the box. But, you know, the likes of Brian Deane, Paul Stewart, Alan Smith, it's a totally different style to a Peter Beardsley. And when we talked through the 93-94 podcast, when we looked at the season review, we talked about how fantastic Beardsley still was on the ball at that point when Keegan signed him at Newcastle. And he hadn't lost any of that. I appreciate, obviously, there was changes at Liverpool at the time. He ends up going to Everton, maybe kind of not the same stature as he was previously. But he certainly hadn't lost any of that sort of flair, that dribbling, that ability to create a chance for another player. And I think that's probably where we start to get this jarring of, we've definitely got one striker that we can trust. So that's Jelinek at this point. But even then, you know, looking at the qualifying for Euro 92 for England, they only score 7 goals in 6 games. So even that, we weren't really a potent striking force. I think Beardsley gets a goal. David Platt is probably, I mean, he wasn't a striker, Platt, but when he was at Villa, Taylor almost used him in that role, didn't he?
Yeah, he was very much a sort of a Lampard before Lampard, wasn't he? You know, sort of coming in, arriving late, scoring goals. You know, I think he gets something like 27 goals in something like 60-odd games or something for England. Yeah, he was almost our hero and saviour throughout that period. I say hero, he didn't really achieve anything, but he always seemed to be, if we ever needed a goal, it seemed to be Platt used to come up with them. And I know that, you know, Lineker got a really vital goal against Poland away to make us qualify for Euro 92. But yeah, it was very much sort of, it was a sort of Platt and Lineker. I say Lineker, as you said, we didn't score many goals. It was mainly Platt. And of course, then Shearer comes in sort of in the France game early 92. And that's when, I suppose, Shearer then really sort of comes on the scene. You know, he doesn't really score anything. I know he scores in his debut, but he's not really scoring goals, knocking on the door, coming in the England team into Euro 92. And of course, he doesn't score at Euro 92. But to be fair, I think as apart from Platt, no one else does either. So, yeah, it's very much, as you say, we've got one striker, Lineker. Who's going to play alongside him? That doesn't really, there's no real answer to that. And then, of course, post-Euro 92, he retires. And then we're looking from scratch for two strikers.
Yeah, and I think that substitution, it's a really famous moment that most people have seen by now. Alan Smith coming on for Gary Lineker. And obviously, if you've seen Lineker's reaction to his substitution, it certainly wasn't something that Lineker was very happy about. But we enter this sort of post-Lineker era. As you say, Shearer's made his debut and he's kind of, I always find it interesting about Shearer. I mean, I know you should never just go off goals and assists and that kind of thing when you're looking at football, but it is something you tend to look at. Shearer, in that 91-92 season, he had a good season. He scored 13 league goals, I think 21 in all competitions. But there was a lot of hype around Shearer as being that sort of next man in line, wasn't he? At the time, obviously, Manchester United were looking to sign him. Blackburn were looking to sign him. Did you think that it was kind of always written in the stars for Shearer a little bit that he would become Lineker's sort of long-term successor, or the jury still being out on him a little bit? Because it wasn't a cut-and-dry thing, was it, with Shearer?
I'm very much on the jury was still out camp, really, because I think he wasn't prolific at Southampton. You know, if you look at sort of Ian Wright, in that season going into Euro 92, he was a top goal scorer in the first division. And you look at, you know, Les Ferdinand, again, slightly older than Shearer. He was scoring goals for QPR. You know, he doesn't come in until that 93. So, you know, it looked as if, to me, as I'm trying to think how old I was now, sort of 11, Shearer wasn't the man that I was looking at as the big money signing for Blackburn. Didn't even think about Blackburn challenging for the title, you know, in sort of two years' time. You saw this project and you just sort of think, well, I can't see where that's going. You know, how wrong am I? But my defence, I was 11. So now I would say that when that transfer went through to Blackburn, it shocked me. But then, of course, the game against Crystal Palace where he scores two fantastic goals, it was literally like, hello, okay, maybe there is something here. And, you know, Dalglish has seen something that perhaps others haven't. And as you said, Ferguson was after him as well. So yeah, it wasn't by any means a dead cert that he was going to be the man going forward, in my mind anyway.
No, and I think definitely that Blackburn side was I think Dalglish realised having that striker like Shearer, he could build a system around a striker like that. Because at the time, Shearer was quick on the ground. He was brilliant in the air. He was strong. He had a powerful shot. He could finish. He was very, very quickly looked like quite a complete striker. Obviously, I wrote in the 92 Birth of Modern Football, I wrote a little bit about sort of the transfer dealings and how that Premier League first started. And Shearer scored 16 goals in 21 games until his injury on Boxing Day and was out for the rest of the season. And I always think over 42 games, you're looking at over 30 goals again. And Blackburn are probably going to push United right to the limit because United were, obviously, as most people know, and we've talked about in 92, 93, it wasn't a dead cert that they were going to win the title. They came from way behind. They obviously had to sign Cantona. But Shearer looked very, very quickly like the finished article. And I think that injury obviously really hurt Blackburn. But as you say, it then threw Taylor into another spin because he had this player who was doing really well domestically and then he couldn't pick him. So there was quite a few choices. I mean, we've talked a little bit about them. When I was actually looking back on this, I'd forgotten Mark Haitley got another cap in 92.
Yeah, I think he played against Czech Republic, I think it was.
Just a single cap, but he had been capped for 4 years. And that, obviously, he was doing well at Rangers and obviously they were dominating. He ended up playing like European Cup Champions League. But again, that was just, it really started to sort of scream of a bit of desperation, didn't it? Because it wasn't really ever going to be a long-term solution. But out of that sort of group when Shearer was injured, there was quite a lot to choose from goal-scoring-wise. But for me, Ian Wright, why did he get overlooked for so long, do you think, under Taylor especially?
It's a really good question because I think, you know, he picked Ferdinand. You know, I'm trying to think who else he picked as well at this point. You know, I think he used Merson quite a lot as well.
I was going to say, I think Merson was in and around that team.
Yeah.
Obviously, he was wider for Arsenal, wasn't he? And he kind of joined in with the forward line. But he wasn't really a striker, was he?
No, I think he sort of used him as a sort of, you know, sort of number 10 almost. But you can't really say Taylor used players as number 10 because I don't think he was that type of manager. But, you know, yeah, he did use Ian Wright. But he didn't nail him on as saying, right, you are my number one striker. He was coming off the bench quite a lot. You know, if you watch the Graham Taylor, you know, documentary, you see him shouting, always looking at Wrighty, going, get Wrighty on. You know, and sort of using him for the last 20 minutes as a sort of impact, using his pace. I really can't answer that because his goal scoring record at Arsenal at this time was as good as any other striker that was going that was around at this time. But he, you know, he just doesn't seem to favour him as his number one striker. You know, I know he scores like 4 goals against San Marino, but anyone could probably have scored 4 goals against San Marino from the group of players we're talking about. It just seems an oddball one that, you know, he's at the prime age, really, that he's not sort of getting those caps and given the trust that he perhaps probably should be getting.
And I think we touched on this a little bit before we were chatting on the podcast, talking about how, obviously, at this point in English football, sort of we're talking about now, sort of 92, 93, 93, 94, we didn't have a lot of strikers from overseas really at all in the league. So there was actually quite a big pool of English strikers who you could argue were good enough in terms of quality. And Ian Wright, for me, was certainly one of them. I do always wonder with Wright whether there was always that little bit of distrust internationally that he couldn't be disciplined, that maybe he wouldn't follow instructions, he might be a bit erratic. And he talks about it a little bit himself, actually. I think I remember him, it was a little bit later on, actually, in the game in Rome for the World Cup 98 qualifying. I think he leads the line in that game, doesn't he? Right. And I think Gazza's in that team as well. And it was sort of the first time that Hoddle had trusted those two to be sensible and actually just get the result. But I do think there was a little bit of, I'm not going to say snobbery around him, but I think his journey to where he got to at Arsenal through, you know, playing a lot more non-league, getting to Crystal Palace, but he was such a regular goal scorer that it always, for me, seems quite odd that he never really got there. I mean, I think he says himself, doesn't he, that at times perhaps he wasn't quite good enough in that environment because obviously at Arsenal, they had such a strong group and obviously George Graham was such a strong manager in the sense that, like, that team was kind of policed by those expert pros, you know, Tony Adams and the like. And maybe Wright was kind of seen as someone who couldn't maybe fit into that international realm. But for me, it always just seems a bit of an odd one. But the other one who I thought was an excellent striker around that time who could, for me, could have led the line, and we've talked about him already, was Les Ferdinand. And I think Ferdinand was such a great striker. And he again had a little bit of unconventional route, didn't he, with his loan spells that he had at Besiktas that kind of got him noticed. But I think for me, someone like Ferdinand, that strength, that power, that aerial ability, that agility, that ability around the box, I think he was quite unique, wasn't he, and quite different to the strikers that were actually available.
Yeah, I think you take Shearer out of the equation. I think you're right, because he's so powerful, he's quick, he's got a great head on him. And if you think how Taylor likes to play football, which, you know, you were talking about long ball, you know, he's the sort of player who would win headers. You would get crosses in from, you know, we used a number of sort of wingers at this time, you know, sort of Mark Walters was tried, and, you know, Stuart Ripley had a couple, and, you know, there was loads of different wingers that would try. Lee Sharp, he didn't get as many caps as he should have done as well. He would have been, you know, almost the ideal player for that role. But again, it's almost like if you didn't score the opportunity you were given, it was almost like, right, we'll find someone else. It's the next one. So no one was really given a clear run of games to say, right, you're the striker for the next five games. You can learn the system, learn the players, you know, because to be fair, he didn't have the time, Taylor, because it was literally Euro 92 was a disaster. And all of a sudden you're on the back foot for USA 94. And all of a sudden you need to find a formula now. And we didn't really find that formula. And it was unfortunate, you know, the likes of Shearer was injured, yes, but Gascoigne always seemed to be injured in this period as well. So we didn't seem to have any real creativity. And I know we talked about David Platt. He seemed to be really good at scoring goals, but he never seemed to be able to, the one who seemed to create the chances. He always just seemed to ghost in and put the ball in, which, again, very important skill. And, you know, I'm glad we had that. But he just didn't seem to have that creativity in midfield to create the chances as well.
That qualifying campaign is kind of where I started to watch England. So obviously the worst possible time to start watching England international. Maybe it's never changed, to be honest. But going from 7 goals in 6 games in the Euro 92 qualifying, I think we scored, I'd got it up, 26 goals in 10 games in that qualifying. But obviously Poland, Turkey and San Marino at that point. I mean, San Marino got beat 10-0 by Norway. So it tells you all you need to know about San Marino at that time. And actually, when you look at the goal scorers, Platt gets 7, Wright gets 5, and Gascoigne gets 4. So on the surface, again, this is what I was saying a little bit before, if you look at sort of goal records, you think, oh, David Platt, 7 goals, you know, stick him up front, stick him as the kind of, because obviously at this point, that withdrawn striker role becomes a little bit more popular, doesn't it? Cantona was doing it for United, where he's kind of playing behind the number 9, rather than like a big man, little man, it became a sort of a second striker, if you like. Could he have filled that role? But then when you actually look at who he was scoring against and when he scored, I think he gets 4 goals in one game, Platt, against...
I think it's San Marino.
Yeah, San Marino, yeah, 6-0. And then I think Wright gets 4 of his, doesn't he, in against San Marino as well. So there's probably not a lot we can glean from where it was headed with those strikers, because it was just getting through the games, wasn't it? And I think the problem for Taylor was he never had that settled system to actually then go and beat a team like Netherlands. I know there was the Koeman instance and all, but he never really got that team right, did he?
No, and I think ironically, if you look at the team that actually went out on the pitch in Rotterdam, that was probably his best team he probably put out for a number of years. And, you know, he had Shearer playing, he had Platt, he had Merce, and Merce was fantastic in that game. And, you know, on another night, we win 1-0. And I know we could go down the Koeman, and I'm not going down that road. Too many wounds there. And then, you know, he's sort of out of a job. And then, you know, we get a new manager come in and, you know, you're looking at a new system and a new way of playing. And it's, I think you almost knew the writing was on the wall as soon as probably the Norway game in the summer, where we obviously lost, and it looked as if Norway were going to win the group and it was always going to be between us and the Netherlands. And then once we didn't do it, it was obvious he was going, and it was all about who was going to come in next, which we obviously know is Venables, and what system he was going to play, which, again, he had a continental sort of base system really from his time at Barcelona. So it was always going to be what system is he going to play? And of course, he went with the Christmas tree.
Yeah, which surprised everyone. Going from Graham Taylor's direct football to a Christmas tree is a very odd move from the FA, I suppose, that, but to be fair to Venables, so if we look at Venables and we look at, just want to pause on sort of the domestic performance of some of the strikers. So the 93-94 season for me is like, it's like peak striker season. Like if you ever look back at the goals and you look at the list of the goal scorers, so you've got, I am going to go through the list for listeners out there. Obviously, feel free to check it out yourselves. But Andy Cole gets 34 league goals. Remember, at this point, the Premier League is 22 teams, so it's obviously 42 games. So Cole gets 34, which was a record at the time. Shearer gets 31. Matt Letizia, who we've not even mentioned yet, and Chris Sutton, we haven't mentioned yet, on 25. Wright on 23. Cole's partner, Peter Beardsley, gets 21. I mean, that's 55 goals between them. Mark Bright was probably another underrated striker who obviously didn't get recognised internationally at 19. Cantona, obviously. Holsworth and Rod Wallace at 17. Then Tony Cotty and Les Ferdinand on 16. That's what Venables was kind of starting from. Within that list, there's no Teddy Sheringham on that list. There's no Dion Dublin on that list, who obviously was going to go to Coventry. It was always going to be Shearer, I think, at this point, wasn't it? Just because he was brilliant. Who would you have gone for as the striker? Obviously, we know Venables goes for Sheringham. Do you think that was the right move at the time? Could Shearer have played with Sutton maybe internationally? Could he have complimented Andy Cole? And maybe later in his career, Shearer could have done that. We'll come on to that when we talk about Michael Owen. But when sort of Venables decided, I'm just going to go for the player who brings the best out of Shearer, would you have gone down that route as well?
No, was the answer to that one, Rob. I remember being, what am I now, 13, and literally I could not understand why Sheringham was in the England team. I was literally like, he doesn't score enough goals. I didn't get the whole, as you say, getting the best out of Shearer, being the one who'd lay the balls off, being unselfish, and getting the best out of Shearer. I always wanted Ferdinand or Ian Wright. They were the two I wanted. I didn't really rate Andy Cole. I know you look at his record in Newcastle and that's a stupid statement, but I always think when he went to Man United, they always used to say he needed five or six chances to score a goal. And I do think there's a degree of truth in that. You know, Beardsley came back under Venables. So, you know, Beardsley was, there was a massive sort of movement on to try and get Beardsley back in the team, which he did. And but as you say, he settled for Sheringham. But no, for me personally, I was going mad. And to be honest, we weren't scoring goals. You know, that whole period, and you know, there's a famous line in the Three Lions song, isn't it, with Jimmy Hill saying, you know, we're not positive enough, we're not creative enough, you know, and you think that's so true. You know, so many games against Bulgaria, Romania, Colombia, Uruguay, they're all 1-1s, 0-0s. Shearer goes through a period where he scores 12, doesn't score in 12 games. You know, you sort of think, well, you know, Shearer's the number one striker. I agree with that. If you look at the stats and what he's doing for Blackburn, he's ripping it up, but he's not doing it on the international stage. And we've got Sheringham, and you think you've got Ferdinand, you've got Ian Wright, you know, you've got the other players you've just mentioned there that are sort of knocking in sort of anything between 15 to 20 goals that don't really get any recognition. Like you say, Mark Bright, you know, I think Kevin Campbell's another one we don't really mention, you know, another player that could have done, I'd say could have done a job. And I'm, you know, that's not really the answer. You want a player that's going to bang them in for England, not do a job. But it just doesn't seem to work for Shearer, for England. But I still think he was the right man to persist with.
It probably made it a bit easier that he was so prolific in domestic football, because it kind of meant everybody sort of went, well, he's got to play Shearer because he's scored this many goals. His team are at the top end of the table. Like you say with Andy Cole, the criticisms around how many chances he needed. I mean, I always find that it's quite difficult for Andy Cole, I think, because when he went to Newcastle, the team was built around him, and Beardsley was effectively Cole's Sheringham. You know, as Sheringham was for Shearer, because he played brilliantly, Beardsley, in that sort of role where he could drift wide a little bit, and it gave Cole the whole width of the box. Whereas I think at United, obviously, you've got Cantona's suspension comes 3 days after Andy Cole makes his debut. He's got to play up front with Mark Hughes, who doesn't actually compliment him at all. You've got kind of Giggs, then you've got Beckham coming through, who's kind of putting a lot of crosses in, which Cole wasn't always used to, because Newcastle played a lot of through balls and run onto it. So it's a tough one to balance out, reason. I suppose this is the thing with international football, isn't it? It's all about thinking about that end result rather than, you know, I must play Cole because he scored a certain amount of goals. I think you're probably right about Ferdinand. I think he could have been someone who actually was almost a foil for Shearer. He could have done a little bit more of the legwork, which I think when Sutton signed for Blackburn in 94, I think Kenny Dalglish knew that actually we probably need someone who can also be as powerful as Shearer up front and could score some goals. I mean, Sutton starts off really well and sort of tails off a little bit. So for me, Sutton was never really someone that I thought was probably right for England. I know there's all the sort of England B stuff, wasn't there, later on with Glenn Hoddle, and he He's got a hat trick at Loftus Road. I feel like I remember in a B international. Was that Letizia?
One of the two against Russia.
Letizia. And then he never really got in. But Ferdinand, I think, would have been a great partner. But he goes for Sheringham, and it doesn't really work up until Euro 96. I think I've just checked, and England in the friendlies that Venables had, plus the Umbro Cup, they had 19 games and they scored 27 goals. So again, not a brilliant return. And defensively, actually, they were probably better than they were from an attacking point of view. And I think that's probably underestimated a little bit about England. But going into sort of that era, we start getting to see a few other players emerge as well. So Letizia comes out as a bit of a goal scorer more than anything now for Southampton under Alan Ball. Is he someone that Venables could have utilised in that second striker role, or was he a little bit too much of a maverick maybe, and he would have had to build his team around him when he's already got Gascoigne, McManaman, Shearer, who kind of probably want to command a lot of attention?
I think I probably, like most people, would probably join the bandwagon sort of that 94-95 season when Letizia was scoring sort of worldies every game. And you sort of think, well, Sheringham is a good player, but I didn't see it internationally. It was only probably Euro 96 where I was like, okay, I get it now. And I think it was like, if you're not going to play right, you're not going to play Ferdinand, and you want to play this player in a sort of withdrawn role, I would have put Letizia ahead of Sheringham. And I know that he gets these opportunities against Ireland away, which again is the game that's abandoned, and he doesn't really sort of get that chance again, really. I know he has that really, really amazing shot against Romania that just goes over the bar, that dips from sort of outside the box. And it's like, well, if that went in, you know, could that have been different if that went in? But again, he was a player who seems to get these opportunities from the bench. And I suppose his last big opportunity, which is under Hoddle, he gets blamed for it, but no, that's down the line. But he seems to come in, doesn't really get the chance, doesn't do it, and then he's dropped again for almost for another couple of years, and then he gets a chance again. But I was screaming for Matt Letizia to be in that England team alongside Shearer. And of course, they play with each other at Southampton. Yes, they were younger then, but you think they know their game a bit, maybe, but it wasn't to be.
Imagine seeing some of those Letizia-type goals in an England shirt, possibly at like Euro 96 at Wembley. They just would have been fantastic moments. But, I mean, I kind of get why Venables didn't pick Letizia. I suppose it's probably too much of a risk when you go into a tournament like that. But at the end of the day, I think, is like you said before, his defence probably helped him out quite a bit. And even if you just took him as a squad player, I don't see any reason why he couldn't have.
No, and I think if you look at so many international teams in this period, sort of in the 80s and the 90s, they all had a number 10, you know, someone who was the playmaker. And we didn't really have that. You know, Sheringham was our playmaker, really. I suppose you can say Gascoigne, but Gascoigne's more of a, if we're talking modern now, he's more of an 8 than a 10. And I think that's where they always say, you know, if Letizia played for France, he would have got 100 caps. And he could have done, and he didn't, and he wanted to play for England, and he ends up with 8 and no goals. So but I understand as well, you say, you know, is he going to track back? No. Is he going to, you know, run himself into the ground? No. He's just going to almost expect the ball to come to his feet like he does at Southampton and just produce moments of magic, perhaps. But I think in international football, you've got to be more than that. You know, players like Zidane, you know, we're talking another level to Letizia, but you can see they've got a determination where I don't think Letizia really had that determination. It was just almost off the cuff. You know, he calls himself a lazy footballer, doesn't he? But as you say, if he scored some moments, you know, some amazing goals at Euro 96 and some moments of brilliance, it would have been fantastic. But I think he just wasn't trusted.
No, and I think that's always going to go against him, Letizia, I think, isn't it, that he wasn't trusting. I do think it's certainly a very English thing that we tend to pick players on what they can't do than what they can. You know what I mean? So how often players haven't been picked because they don't track back, and you think, well, if you can score a 35-yard strike with the inside of your right foot into the top corner against pretty good goalkeepers, I don't really care. And I think Letizia says it about Alan Ball, doesn't he? They had training sessions with how to get the ball to Letizia or where he's going to be on the pitch and get the ball into him, because he's the one who's going to create for us. The rest of you can't. So why try? You know, it's that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I always remember that about Alan Ball. It's like, you know, he's your best player. Give him the ball. He's the one who will get us out of relegation. And that's almost a team talk and the tactics, wasn't it? And as you say, you know, you can go back to the 80s. You look at someone like Glenn Hoddle, you know, wasn't trusted enough to be in the team because he wouldn't track back. He wouldn't do tackling. You think, yeah, but he can play a 50, 60-yard pass to someone's foot and he can create something out of nothing. And, you know, we prefer to go with Ray Wilkins. And ironically, you know, he gets sent off in the World Cup in 86 and Hoddle comes in and we sort of slowly get better. But, you know, it's, as you say, it's about that trust, isn't it? It's like, oh, he won't do that, so we won't pick him. But he can run around a lot and he can put his foot in and he can, you know, get a tackle. And it's like, well, yeah, that's why you've got centre-backs or that's why you've got David Batty in the team or Paul Ince. You know, that's their job. Your job is to go and do something at the other end and create a moment of magic and chaos. But, you know, that's, as you say, we had Gascoigne. So, you know, could you have got Gascoigne and Letizia in the team? Probably not. Not if they're going to be in. Gascoigne's always got that discipline mark, isn't he? You know, is he going to press the, you know, the red button and get himself a yellow card or something? And you've got a player who's not going to run and just going to say, I want the ball here. And probably not going to work. But it sounds good. It sounds good. If it worked, it would have been brilliant.
Yeah, it sounds good. It sounds good when we can talk about it now, 30 years down the line, doesn't it? One thing that I did notice, and I've just brought it up again in front of me, I've got the England Euro 96 squad. And one thing that you notice about that squad, and we'll sort of talk about some of the players who were considered around this time, is how young and inexperienced it is as a squad. And I think part of that is a hangover from how many players Graham Taylor used. I did tot it up at one point. I'm sure it's over 50 players he used for England, or 54 or something like that. But when you look at the squad, obviously it was in squad numbers. Once you get to Darren Anderton, who's number 11 in the squad list, everybody's got 10 or more caps, apart from Gareth Southgate, who's got 4. Bearing in mind, he comes in and starts a few of the games at that point. He's, what, 25? I mean, Paul Ince at this point has got 19 caps and he's 28.
And he comes in about 92, so he doesn't... Post-Euro 92, he comes in, which is just sounds mad when he sort of plays for West Ham 88, 89, goes to United in 89 and doesn't then get in the England team for 3 years later. Just seems ludicrous.
Mad. And you've got, you know, the likes of Nick Barmby, 22, Redknapp, 22, Sol Campbell's 21. But from a striker's point of view, we've got Les Ferdinand, who's got 10 caps and is 29. And the other striker in the squad has got 3 caps at age 21. And that's a certain Robbie Fowler. Now, 93 to 96 for Robbie Fowler is just a brilliant period of like unbridled joy at scoring goals. I think when you watch that peak Robbie Fowler, him and Shearer, it's almost like Fowler came at the wrong time. Like if he could have been 3 years after Shearer retired, he'd have been England's number 9 with Rooney, you know, starting every game. If he'd come 3 years before Shearer, he'd have been starting probably with, instead of, or with Gary Lineker. But he comes at that time and he hits that peak just as Shearer's hitting a peak. But he was a phenomenal, phenomenal striker, wasn't he, Robbie Fowler?
Oh, definitely. You know, he got a really good relationship with Ian Rush sort of instantly. I think Rush, he knew that he'd lost his pace and became the experienced one who'd almost, he would be the target man and just let Fowler just score all sorts of amazing goals. You know, they were headers, they were tap-ins, they were long-range finishes. I remember the one against Villa, he sort of does that little Cruyff sort of half turn and let rip with his left foot in the top corner. And it's just like, I can't remember what season that was, but it was just like, oh my God, this player could almost do anything. And as you say, it was just the wrong time. And I think when he got his chances for England, he didn't seem to take them. But was that because he wasn't given the service? Was that because... who he was playing with. I think he played against Mexico, I think, sort of running up the 96. I think he scored in that game, actually. But yeah, as you say, he was just really unlucky that all of a sudden he's playing at the same time that Shearer is. Venables wants to play with another type of striker, a deep-lying striker, someone who's going to create opportunities for Shearer. And Fowler had Shearer in the way. And it's pretty much as simple as that. But as you say, for that period between... you know, when he gets his injuries of 97, 98, he was phenomenal.
And I think that's that's the point I was going to make next, actually. You've got Sheringham getting selected to partner Shearer to kind of make that, you know, complementary partnership. We all probably, I mean, there's a lot of people who probably forget about that because Euro 96 feels like such a high because it's the Sheringham and Shearer show in the Holland game. So you automatically think Sheringham was a shoo-in. No one else should have been picked. When actually, behind all that, there was quite a lot of strikers underneath all of this that were kind of good enough probably to play and start or whatever for England. So Fowler's kind of, for me, I feel like Fowler at this time probably should have been the Shearer reserve and you just keep going with him. I mean, Shearer was quite durable at this point. He starts getting injured, I think, again when he goes to Newcastle, doesn't he, after his original Blackburn injury. So we move out of Euro 96 and we get into that sort of 96-97 season and football starts to change a little bit in England. So sort of that period we get Jurgen Klinsmann signs for Spurs in 94-95. And I think the Premier League start to wake up to the fact that post USA 94, there's actually other football that happens outside of England. You know, incredibly, there are players that we could buy to actually improve our team from other leagues. And there's obviously a bit more money around. So we get Klinsmann. 95, we get Hullett. You know, there's other, I mean, Jan Agerfjordoft was at Swindon, came to my club, Middlesbrough, in 94-95 and played in the Premier League 95-96. I think he might have top scored for us with 9 or 8, something like that. So hardly prolific. And then the 96 summer, we get Gianluca Vialli. We eventually get Gianfranco Zola, I think in about November time. And Middlesbrough spend big on Fabrizio Ravanelli. So the sort of dynamic around the strikers that were available to clubs starts to sort of change, doesn't it, post-Euro 96? Oh, the other one I actually forgot there, post-Euro 96, is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. What was he, 1.5 million, I think? So even Ferguson, who'd always thought, you know, before he bought Andy Cole, it was all about Stan Collymore, wasn't it? Before he went in for Shearer, it was all about David Hurst. He'd always gone for kind of, I want the best English striker that I can get kind of thing. But even he starts to move that way. And that 96 is probably the shift, isn't it, where we start to see some of these overseas strikers coming in.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you mentioned Stan Collymore, and I think that's another player that we haven't really talked about. You know, is that sort of was it 94-95 season for Forest? He was on fire.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Brian Roy. You know, Brian Roy, you know, comes from USA 94, so there's another one there. So you can see the influence of sort of foreign players, as you said, coming in. Goes to Liverpool to go alongside Fowler, and it doesn't really work. You know, you think on paper, Fowler and Collymore, they should be absolutely smashing it up. But how much of that is the Spice Boys and, you know, off the field and all those sort of things? But as you say, post-96, you know, the strikers come in. But you've also got players like Karol Poborski and Jordi Cruyff and all these other players that seem to have done well at Euro 96. It's almost like the managers have just gone, oh, yeah, I remember him. Oh, he looked good and we'll go and buy him. And, of course, they're cheap, you know, and that's the other thing. There's an untapped resource there. If you go to sort of Eastern Europe or Portugal or places like that, these players are cheap compared to, you know, you think Collymore's gone for 8.5 in 95 and now you can go over to Norway and pick up Solskjaer for 1.5 million. Now, that, don't get me wrong, that's a gamble because that, you know, it could have gone either way. But £1.5 million, and I know that probably sounds like a lot of money in 96, but you're buying Ravanelli for 7 million, 1.5, if it goes wrong, it's not the end of the world, is it? So you can take the gamble, and of course, you know, Solskjaer, it works out rather well. But then, as you say, but you still got a number of English players that, you know, Hoddle can now choose for going forward towards France 98. And he picks the same players, let's be honest. But he brings Ian Wright back. He really seems to like Ian Wright, Glenn Hoddle. And of course, Alan Shearer, he gets injured in 97, doesn't he? So he has that season with Les Ferdinand. Of course, Shearer and Ferdinand together, that's the season in 96-97 where they score, I can't remember how many goals they score. I'm sure you've got the figure there, Rob. But they absolutely smash it up, the two of them. Don't obviously win the league. Keegan goes tail end of 96, beginning of 97. They always said those two couldn't play together, couldn't they? But they definitely could. But Hoddle still keeps going for sharing alongside Shearer up front.
Yeah, and I think that was the really safe option. And like you say, Ferdinand and Ferdinand had been excellent the season before, hadn't he? I always remember Les, I mean, obviously as a Middlesbrough fan, we just got promoted back to the Premier League that season. So it was incredibly infuriating that Newcastle were sort of fighting for a title at the top end of the table. And they had Les Ferdinand, who in his first season at Newcastle scored 25 goals. So that was 95-96. So again, the top three strikers actually that season, pre-Euro 96, Shearer 31, Fowler 28, and Les Ferdinand 25. And that's it, just league goals. Then you've actually got Dwight York, who starts to get goals. Andre Kanchelskis obviously does fantastically well for Everton. Another one we haven't mentioned actually, Chris Armstrong, who actually went to Spurs and scored goals, didn't he? He was basically Klinsmann's replacement. You're on about prices. He cost Spurs, I think, £4.5 million in 95, which, when you think about it, was enormous. A huge, huge signing.
Very much so.
Colin Moore gets his 14 in that sort of second striker role for Liverpool, which for £8.5 million might not feel like a big return, but I think it was a good sign at the time. It just, I mean, there's obviously other things that went on with Colin Moore that maybe didn't help him to meet his potential, but still a fantastic striker for Forest in that first season. In that 97 season, you were talking about Shearer and Ferdinand. So Shearer gets 25 goals and Ferdinand gets 16. So 41 goals between them. And I do think that the type of manager that Hoddle was, I'm surprised that he liked Ian Wright so much, because he was very much, you know, he wanted players to be a bit more technical, didn't he, or more technically minded. A lot of his coaching was driven around that, and he liked to play players who could play the ball, basically. And I think maybe Ian Wright didn't always fit that, but like you say, he mainly went with Sheringham anyway, didn't he? In terms of goal scorers in that season, so Solskjaer gets 18, that's 96-97. Dwight York, 17, and Ravanelli, 16. Ravanelli got 31 goals in all competitions for £7 million, and he scored in a Champions League final. So again, that's probably, I know we got relegated that season, but still, probably pretty good value for money if we'd have turned up at Blackburn. But you've got Den Janino, and probably the other player to mention, and we talked a little bit about second strikers before, was Dennis Bergkamp, who obviously went to Arsenal and was absolutely amazing.
Very much so. I said to you before, I went to that Arsenal Middlesbrough game and it was all about Platt, Bergkamp, and of course Nicky Barmby. And there's another one we haven't talked about. You know, Nicky Barmby turns up and, you know, ex-Tottenham scores against Arsenal. But he was just a different player again. You know, because, you know, first of all, everyone was, the first month or so, people were moaning about Bergkamp, saying it was a complete waste of money. And then he scores those two cracking goals against Southampton. And all changes, and you know, he then sort of comes. He's probably one of the top three, top five greatest foreign imports. You know, you look at Henri, Bergkamp, Cantona, probably from the 90s, early 2000s. They're the players that I would automatically go towards. Just such a clever player, always seemed to have time, always seemed to be one, two, three steps ahead. And he also had a nasty side to him as well. He had a nasty streak to him, Bergkamp. He could put his elbow in and he could put his foot in and look very innocent. And he didn't always get away with it, but he was just a class above pretty much everybody else. And unfortunately, he wasn't English, and that was the problem.
Yeah, it's true. And it's interesting how Ian Wright obviously dovetailed so well with Bergkamp at that time, as obviously before Anelka arrives. And I always wonder what Wright and Sheringham would have done for England. You know, if that had been a partnership that had been allowed to flourish, because obviously Sheringham, not the same type of player as Dennis Bergkamp, but certainly more in that sort of withdrawn role. But to take a moment to go back to Robbie Fowler, you sort of hinted at it before. And I certainly remember May 1997, listening to the radio. I didn't listen to other football on the radio. It was very much Century FM, which had Middlesbrough's games on the radio. It must have been Five Live or something like that, but it was Liverpool versus Wimbledon, and a certain Michael Owen scores a goal, and the commentators must say something like, you know, he's a name to remember, or we all know about this Michael Owen or whatever, and you think, oh, okay, you know, it's another new player who's going to, you'd be able, because at that my age, that time, what am I, 12, 11, 12 at that point? So it's Merlin Sticker albums, Championship Manager. So you're looking out for reading World Soccer to find out which players you're going to go and buy on the next season's Championship Manager. And then Fowler gets injured and then Owen is just let in. And that changes Fowler's career completely. doesn't it? I mean, he basically stops being the player he was. That 93 to 97 is Fowler's peak, and probably he's half a player when he comes back. But all of a sudden, Liverpool and England have got a phenomenon in Michael Owen, who is, we might have talked about, you know, Ferdinand being similar to Shearer, Sutton being similar to, but Owen was, he was completely different to the rest, and he was just incredible to watch. So exciting.
Well, I remember that game where he came on, and I was exactly like you, because there was this talk about this young kid, and he was ripping it up. The youth team, he'd scored, like, I don't know, almost sound like he scored like 250 goals in like 10 games or something they were banging on about. And, you know, he sort of, it was a really good finish, the way he sort of gets the ball and then puts it in the opposite corner. And you sort of think, like you say, oh, here's another one that, you know, would come and, you know, appear and disappear. Bit like Richie Humphreys for Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah, I was just about to say Richie Humphreys. He's everybody's go-to mid-90s wonder kid that didn't do anything. Were they top of the league after five games or something, Sheffield Wednesday, or four games, wherever it was?
Yeah, he scores that wonder goal against Leicester, and then it's all downhill from them. But it's, you know, Owen is really lucky, as you say, because Fowler gets that injury. Sort of does his, was it ACL, I think it is. And as you say, he loses, I'd probably say, more than half a yard of pace when he comes back. He's not as mobile as he once was. He's not as electric as he once was. He could still finish, but I don't think he could get in the position that he got into before so quickly with Fowler. And then, of course, Shearer gets his injury in 97 in the summer. So all of a sudden, you've now got Fowler and Shearer both injured going into that last part of the qualifying period for France 98. Hence, Ian Wright comes into the side because, of course, he gets his debut in 98 against Chile, doesn't it? And that's the game where Salah scores that unbelievable goal. And that game is all about Owen's debut, and Salah is like, no, it's not, it's about me. And he scores that brilliant goal.
What a player Salas was, by the way. I remember, is that the game that was before he got linked to United? Because Man United wanted him, didn't they, for like 12 million or 15 million? I think he goes to Lazio instead, doesn't he? I can never remember if that was before or after, but I remember watching that on the news thinking, wow, if Manchester United get him, this changes the league. But yeah, overshadows Owen massively, but still.
I think going back to Salas, I remember playing Championship Manager in 97, 98, and he was playing for like Universidad de Chile or something, and was really cheap. And he was a player that everyone was trying to buy. And because you knew there were rumours knocking around about United, and as you say, he went to Lazio because that was still was the top league. That was the league that was still clinging on, really. That was paying £25 million for players, where we weren't doing that. Yeah, maybe we didn't. I don't think he went for 25, to be fair. But, you know, it wasn't long before Crespo was going for those silly numbers in sort of 98, 99. And Chiesa and players like that. But, you know, as I said, Owen's really lucky that Shearer, Fowler are injured. And then Ian Wright gets injured just before France 98. But, of course, Shearer's back by then. So, you know, Owen's scoring goals. Ferdinand's gone to Spurs by this point, isn't he? And he's not scoring as many goals, I don't think, as he was for Newcastle. Once he sort of gets sort of 16 league goals in 96, 97. I don't know what he got for Tottenham, but I think he's like 15 or 16 goals. I don't think he gets as many.
Yeah, he's not even in the top. So in 97, 98, he's not in the top goal scorers in the league. So he doesn't get third. Paolo Wanchope with 13 is kind of at the bottom of that list of top 10. So he's not even in that. I mean, Darren Huckabee gets more goals than him in the league, so says it all.
But Ferdinand goes to France 98 at the expense of Dion Dublin. But of course, Ian Wright doesn't, because he gets injured in the King Hassan Cup, I think it is. But of course, Sheringham still knocking around. Shearer comes back from his injury. And I think it's the game against Portugal where England win 3-0. And I think that's the one where they both, Sheringham and Shearer both play up front. Sheringham scores a fantastic goal from outside the box. And I think that's the one where Coddle's literally like, right, that's my forward line. They're back. Yes, I've got other injuries, but there are other players. But my main forward line going into France 98 is Sheeran and Sheringham. And they played up front against Portugal. And that Portugal side was not a bad side. You know, we sort of Rui Costa, Figo, João Pinto, Couto at the back. You know, good side. and we beat them 3-0. So, yeah, and so Owen was always going to be on the bench. In my mind, it was going to be, is he going to get an opportunity? That's the question.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the league season, that's it. I always remember this one because, well, we weren't in the Premier League, but I always remember the joint top goal scorers in that league, because it was 18 goals and there was three players who shared it, and it was Dion Dublin, Michael Owen and Chris Sutton. I always remember just those three sharing it, and Chris Sutton not getting picked, Dion Dublin not getting picked, but Michael Owen getting picked. And it didn't really take that long for Owen to actually get involved, and he scored in that friendly. Was it Morocco, I think, just before France 98? I think in the May or back end of May, wasn't it? One of the warm-ups. Classic Owen finish that you kind of think, well, actually, that's how we need to be playing. You know, that's how we're going to get the best out of him in that fashion.
Yeah, I think if I remember, I've seen the goal, and it's very grainy footage on YouTube, and I think he sort of gets it on the left. He sort of runs in, scores. It's not necessarily the best finish, but again, I'm only going by very grainy footage. And you can see what he can do, because he's just got this electric pace. You know, if you look at all the other players that we've got, they're fantastic finishers, but he's got something different. He's not going to be knocking goals in from corners with his head and getting on the end of free kicks. He is just sheer pace and is going to run at you. And if you can kick a ball over the top of the centre-backs and run onto it, he's going to be there in a flash. And he proved for Liverpool all season that he could finish. I know, sort of, you know, Hoddle made that famous statement saying he's not a natural goal scorer. And it's like, well, he is, because his game is all about pace and finishing, because that's all he really was doing at this point, because that's all he needed to do. You know, once he gets his own injuries, I think it's against Leeds the year after, and he does his hamstring, and then he has to adapt and doesn't. He's not the same player that he was. But in this period, which to me is still peak Owen period, he was just so fast off the blocks.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing you can't legislate for. Like Brazilian Ronaldo at this point, France 98, like his feet move faster than people can run. You know, he's just so quick. I mean, there's obviously, there's those famous pictures where I think it is from France 98, and his feet are almost a blur. You know, have whatever effect they've put on the picture. But it felt like that when you actually watched him. And it felt like Michael Owen, you'd never had a player like that before that you could just use as like a speed demon sort of in behind. Like all the other players that England were bringing on. Even Fowler was quick. But Fowler was quick with his brain, and that allowed him to get a bit of space, or he'd run off his man, or he'd get a bit of space around the edge of the box. This was just, I can run faster than all of you. Like, I know you joked before about his 250 goals in 10 games for the youth team. But to be honest, he probably was, because there'll be no one who could actually keep up with him to stop him from scoring goals. Because, I mean, his finishing, some of his finishes that he used to do, the ones I loved of Owen around that time was that curling finish that he used to do, you know, around goalkeepers. Like Ronaldo says, again, 1990s Ronaldo, not the Portuguese one, he would say, I want to go around the goalkeeper because I've got an open goal every time. And I know I've got skill. So you'll see a lot of the time he'll put a goalkeeper on his backside and just tap the ball in. Whereas Owen was very much, well, if I curl it into the top corner or right low into the corner, you can't touch it. There's no goalkeeper that can save it. And I think he was such a clever player in that sense. People, Shearer was a little bit more, you know, I'm going to leather it past you when I get one-on-one. But Owen was a lot more, maybe a bit more considered with his finishing. And he was actually probably a bit underrated as a poacher. So before this, I watched all of his goals for England. And he scores so many little headers, you know, in 5 yards out, or like he sticks his foot out. He just had that natural instinct where he was desperate to get a goal. We probably can't move on until we talk about the goal against Argentina, because I think it'll be a little bit silly not to. I remember I think my dad had gone out to watch the game. I can't remember what night it was on, but I was watching it on my own upstairs in my bedroom on my small little portable TV, because my mum didn't want to watch any football downstairs while my dad was out. And I was like, brilliant, thanks for that. So I just remember being like amazed. And you just, at the time, especially because I'd not seen us in a World Cup at that point. I'd not seen us, obviously, in Italia 90 because I was 5. But it just felt like a real moment in your like football life. You know, I've seen this happen live. And, you know, as a football fan, and I know we're sort of fans who are looking back on earlier memories of our football fandom, but that's just such a moment that really sticks in the mind and just brilliant.
See, I remember I was watching this one at home because my mum and dad went to the pub for this, and I went to the pub for the Romania game, and for many reasons we weren't allowed back to the pub. Now, bear in mind, I was only 16 at the time, and it was the pub I used to work in, and we were told by my boss, if he catches us with a drink, we're sacked. And we didn't have a drink. We were really good, but the pub went after Romania got the winner. It, in typical England fashion, the pub went wrong, and it would become an all ticket affair, and you had to prove your age. So we were banned from the pub. So I watched this game at home with my mates in the front room, and it was such an electric game. The penalty, Battistuta, Shearer penalty, and then this happened. And it was also quick. I think it's like after 16, 17 minutes, it's 2-1. Owen's just, and he'd already scared him earlier on. Because I think he won the, did he win the penalty? I think he won,
yeah,
the,
he
penalty.
Won the penalty. Yeah, he got, yeah.
And then there's that line from Brian Moore. He says he's gonna scare him again, or he's going to, you know, worry him again. And of course, he just runs past them all. And I think it's Ayala that's so far back that there was no danger of you being offside, because he's almost on the 6-yard box and Owen's on the halfway line. But it's just, he just runs at them and runs at them. And because I wouldn't say Owen was necessarily a skillful player. He was going to do you with some outrageous skill. He just did you because he's just gone straight past you before you've known, you know, because if you're square on, you know, we say defenders hate pace, and this bloke had pace and some, and was just straight past you. And as you said, he could finish. And I think, you know, you always remember, you know, Scholes is coming in to leather it himself. And you're almost expecting Scholes to smack Owen's foot and completely bodge it all up. But as he said, you know, if I kick it high past the other side of the goal, Rowe's got no chance. And that's exactly what it does. And it's just an amazing goal. And as you know, the first game I went to the pub was against Romania. When Owen scored against Romania, that was the first time I'd ever been in a pub when England scored. And it was just unbelievable. You know, with beer in the air and everyone going mad, everyone hugging everyone, very sort of British, you know, everyone's all in a pub, not talking to everyone. As soon as someone scores, you don't care, you cuddle, pick someone up, you'd never know. And then the game starts again and all that, you're back to as you were, you know, not doing that anymore. And I was just, can only imagine what that was like to be at a pub, to see that goal live in a pub, and being unbelievable. But it was such a moment. And then, of course, everything, I suppose it goes wrong after Beckham's red card, but I've got to say that I still say that Zanetti free kick is one of the best free kicks you'll ever see. It's so clever. It's not something that England would do. It's just so clever. I can't really say anything else. And then of course Beckham gets sent off, and then it's all going wrong. But for a moment in time with Owen and that goal, you just think, oh my God, we could beat Argentina here, and we could go on. And we've got an absolute superstar. And I think the only other player that I've ever felt like that since was Rooney in 2004.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing. It was watching a superstar being born. And I think you could still watch that happen, because football is so kind of saturated now that you pretty much know every single player who's coming up from 16, 17, 18. But this really felt like that end of that 96-97 season. He arrived. Only people in Liverpool probably knew who he was. Scores the goal. He gets joint top scorer in 97-98, and he's a superstar by the end of the summer. And it's just totally transformed his whole life just on that one moment, isn't it, really? I mean, he would have made it anyway, let's be honest, if he hadn't have scored that goal. But it puts him into absolute different sort of league completely. I think with someone like Owen, probably a little bit like Rooney in that 2004, isn't it? It's kind of, the success of the team is not solely in his hands. Shearer probably felt that way a little bit pre-Euro 96. It was kind of, what was it, goal drought, a 24-game goal drought, wasn't it, for Shearer before the tournament?
12.
It's only 12. Not as many as I thought.
12 games, it's still a year. I think it's about 13 months or something like that.
Yeah. So he probably felt the weight of that. Then you've got kind of 98, Owen becomes kind of the hero of got the team, and then Rooney, obviously, later on. And then, I suppose with that, Owen, obviously, like you say, gets a little bit of an injury later. Shearer, you know, keeps getting injured over the next... He gets injured like once every 3 years, doesn't he? Basically, Shearer. And he's out for a bigger period of time, I suppose. So, I mean, rounding off the the decade, I suppose. Owen's the main man. We know Owen's kind of, he's in there. He's sort of the first choice. Who were some of the other strikers that were around at that time, sort of with Shearer and Owen, competing for that starting berth for England? I feel like this is where it starts to decline a little bit, to be honest.
It does. You're quite right. You know, Kevin Phillips at Sunderland, you know, they have that season where he, I think it's 99, 2000 or 98, 99 they come up. But he's sort of on the scene. Dion Dublin's still knocking around, but doesn't really get many chances. I think he gets another chance post France 98, but is forgotten about. Heskey obviously comes into the team, and of course it's then Heskey and Owen the ones that then take it on into the sort of Ericsson era. But under sort of Keegan, you know, sort of Heskey gets his debut, I think, against Argentina in February 2000. Sort of Fowler still knocking around, you know, Fowler still gets a few caps. But it almost seems to be every game seems to be almost a different two. You know, sort of Scholes plays. Didn't Scholes play a bit further forward? He gets a hat-trick against Poland, but
he scored a couple against Scotland as well, didn't he? I think in the playoffs for Euro 2000, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember if he was playing as a 10 or an 8, but the forward line really is still Shearer and Owen, and then it's then, you know, that's the forward line at Euro 2000. Don't want to talk about Euro 2000.
We're staying in the 90s.
Yeah, but it was still Shearer and Owen with the front two post 98. Sheringham was still knocking around. You know, he still goes to Japan, Korea 2002. But it's literally whenever one of Owen or Shearer is injured, it's then who do you play instead? And there's not really a designated backup player who really stakes a claim to be that third player. It's a number of players tried out again, similar to the Taylor era, really, that doesn't really work until you get Heskey being the foil to Owen.
Which is, again, is similar to the Sheringham as a foil to Shearer, isn't it? You're just sort of picking the player that gets the best out of the other one. Because I still don't think Shearer and Owen actually complemented each other that well, really. They did in the sense they had different skill sets, but actually the style of play in terms of football, you actually needed to play differently for the two of those players. I know Shearer got a little bit different. And actually the later version of Shearer, when Bellamy was at Newcastle, was probably more of a good fit if he'd have been like that with Owen. Obviously retired at Euro 2000. But we talked, I read it before about the 93-94 goal scorers list and, you know, who was in there. And the top scorer of the league now in that treble season for United got 18 goals in the season, in a 38-game season now, obviously. That was Dwight York, who got 18. Michael Owen, 18. And Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, 18 as well. So already you're starting to see two of the top three aren't English. Then you've got Andy Cole, 17. Then you've got Nicholas Anelka, 17. The legendary, you know, if you've not read this player's autobiography or you've not looked at the Wikipedia, check them out. Sixth. Do you know who would have been sixth that season? 98-99. Not English. Played for Middlesbrough.
I was going to say
Brian Dean. Hamilton Rickard.
Oh, God.
Can you believe he was the sixth highest goal scorer in the league? Can't believe it. He scored more than Shearer and Fowler. And then you've got Shearer, Fowler. Then Julian Joachim, actually, with 14 goals. And Joachim, I think it was in 92, 93, when he was just coming up at Leicester. He was the star, actually. It was Joachim, Fowler, Caskey and Barmby, wasn't it? I think they were the four who they thought were going to be the core of the England team going into that decade, which is very interesting, isn't it?
Well, I think they won the Toulon tournament in 93. And it's funny, if I did actually jump Julian Joachim down, and I'm not just saying that because I remember him at Villa because he was very quick. And I remember him at Leicester because I remember he played for Leicester when they played Brighton in the League Cup, Cocoa Cup, and we beat them and we were in the old third tier and they're the Premier League team. And that was quite a coup. But again, he was a decent player, but he never hit the heights of scoring goals. Darren Caskey, another player, he was a good player, but he didn't really kick on and score the goals. But you say those numbers from the 98-99 season, you're talking almost 10, 15 goals less than they were scoring in 94-95. And you sort of think, why is that? You know, is that, you can't tell me that the defenders have got better because you've now got the likes of Yap Stam coming over, you've got Desailly coming over, where before, with all due respect, you've got the players like Gary Breen and other players like that playing.
Phil Wheeler.
Yeah. you know, for other teams at the back, like Southampton, you know, and players. I'm trying to think of some sort of, you know, Ken Mancur or players like that. You know, you sort of think, well, they're not at the same level, perhaps, and that's maybe why these strikers were scoring more goals. Yes, there was more games, I get, but you're only talking another four games in a season.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not actually that many. Obviously, a 46-game, like the Championship now, for example, a 46-game season, you know, eight games more than the Prem is quite a lot, but going from 42, I mean, and as well, most players missed a couple of games in a season anyway, so maybe we're playing 38 to 40 anyway, but it is interesting how it's really until, like you say, Kevin Phillips comes in. So Sunderland get promoted in 99 after losing the playoff final in 98, and he gets 30, and he actually gets the European Golden Boot that season, if I remember rightly, Phillips. And that's when Shearer gets goals again. But then you've got Cole and York at United, and they're getting sort of over 40 goals between them as well. So again, it's a very different landscape, I suppose. Let's finish on that one, actually. 99-2000 season, right? So these are our top 10. One of the players in here I absolutely love, and again, is another one who's hurt by injury. So you've got Phillips with 30, Shearer 23, York 20, Andy Cole 19, and this is the player, Michael Bridges at Leeds. What a player. That this season, he was absolutely brilliant. Henry 17, Di Canio 16. Then you had Iverson and Armstrong at Spurs, who got 14 each.
I can't believe Iverson scored 14 goals. He never scored.
And then Quinn got 14 as well. So you can just see it again. You've got York, Henry, Di Canio, and Stefan Iverson in there. And obviously, the field of strikers is diluted, isn't it? Much more now, you know, at this point in time. And especially because some of those players who are still knocking about, like your likes of Dion Dublin, he's too old for England now. You know, Shearer has retired for England at this point. Sheringham is at Portsmouth at this point. No, back at Spurs, isn't he? Back end of
Spurs,
early 2000s. Yeah. So they're all kind of on the wane. Fowler's bouncing between Leeds, then Man City, doesn't he? Early 2000s as well. So, yeah, a very different time, I think, at the back end of there. So, I mean, for me, Michael Bridges, I wish it's just, again, if he'd not had that injury, what a sort of third striker, fourth striker in the England squad he could have been. Because that Leeds team was going places, obviously. You know, in that Leeds fire sale, I wonder if Bridges would have been fit, where he would have ended up. Because obviously, Viduka ends up at Borough. Kewell ends up at Liverpool. Bridges, I think he just kind of tails off, doesn't he? Because he can't really stay fit. But is there anyone we've missed? Any English strikers we missed? Maybe ones who didn't have a chance of the national team?
I think players, like I said, I've jotted a load of names down earlier on, you know, this week. And I think players that... honourable mentions, and these players are not players that you would call up to England, don't get me wrong, but I think players like Mark Robbins, you know, you mentioned Tony Cotty earlier on, Rod Wallace, I know he was more of a sort of winger that were cut in, but he scored loads of goals for Leeds. You know, Lee Chapman in the early part of the decade, target man. I said Nigel Clough, we talked about briefly, but, you know, Steve Ball was there post Italia 90. I know he was playing for Wolves in the Championship. He did actually play a couple of games post Italia 90, but then he seemed to sort of fall off the international radar. I know you mentioned Dean Holdsworth later on, but you know, John Fashanu was still knocking around. You know, he went to Villa sort of 93. You know, he had a couple of caps in the 80s, but he wasn't really international class, to be honest with you. But they were all players that as I said earlier on, right at the beginning, when I mentioned Graham Stewart and Paul Rideout, these were players that all sort of scored 10, 12 goals a season for their clubs. And you now look at English strikers scoring 10, 12 goals in the Premier League now, I'm struggling to think of many.
Yeah, I mean, what did Solanke's had one really top season before getting his big move to Spurs. He's always around sort of the low teens, wasn't he, I think, for Bournemouth. He was a good player, you know, a solid striker, but you certainly look back on the 90s and you think he's not getting into that Euro 96 squad. He's not probably competing all with, he's probably a bit of a Chris Sutton, you know, a good striker at that level, you know, if you want to be at the top end of the table, but he's going to be a bit hot and cold. Who else is there? Obviously Kane at Bayern, he'd probably score in any year, I think Harry Kane, wouldn't he?
Yeah, Kane's the exception, isn't he? You know, he's like your Shearer and your Lineker from that period where he's always going to score goals no matter what. But, you know, if you're looking at players like, you know, Watkins, I could see Watkins almost being, you know, almost like an Ian Wright or a...
Andy Cole even.
Yeah, that Andy Cole, you know, again, he's not going to be better or going to score as many goals as Kane, but he's going to do a job. you know, that, don't get me wrong, that goal he scored against Netherlands in the Euros recently was
superb.
Unbelievable. It was unbelievable. But again, I'm now really struggling. You know, Callum Wilson, a really good player, never fit. Never fit. You know, Calvert-Lewin,
same old story. Yeah.
He's never fit. You know, at the moment, he seems to be actually staying fit for Everton, but he's, you know, missed that horrible chance the other day when he tried to take around the goalie, didn't he? And that didn't work.
And he's fit now. He's fit now. He's in the last year of his contract.
Yeah.
Playing for another one, I think.
I'm not being cynical by any chance, are you, Rob?
Not at all.
No. You know, Vardy still, you know, has reappeared all of a sudden and he's scoring goals. But again, you know, as I said, I jotted down about 35 names the other day and I couldn't get anywhere near that now. Nowhere near.
No, it's certainly a very unique landscape because even if you were to look in the 1980s or the 1970s, I don't think you would get the depth of striking quality that you get in this period of the 90s. I think that post-Lineker 92, probably till the emergence of Owen in 98, that group of strikers, you know, you go down the list, Shearer, Sheringham, Fowler, Cole, Collymore, Owen, Wright, Ferdinand, just that eight. I mean, managers tend to pick, what, three or four strikers in an international squad? So you've got another four who can't get anywhere near. That's without Sutton, Merson, Letizier. You know, mentioned Nick Barmby, who kind of was a bit in and out of England. And I think he ended up on the left, didn't he, at one point when he was more of a... He was more of a forward that became midfielder, wasn't he? But certainly a very, very unique period in football and fits in quite well with some of the issues we've talked about in terms of the way football was changing in the 1990s. But if I was to ask you to pick one who you would pull into the modern game for your club, who would you pick?
It would still be Alan Shearer.
It's got to be, hasn't it?
I think just because his goal-scoring record is just, I say slightly better, it's not, it's consistent as well. But I want the Blackburn Shearer and not the Newcastle Shearer.
100%, yeah. Something changed with that move, didn't it? It changed the way he played.
Yeah, I think the second ACL injury or whatever his other injury was doesn't help because he loses definitely a yard or two of pace. But that Blackburn Shearer was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal.
For me, whatever's happening in the Premier League now with Haaland and all those goals and that kind of thing, for me, Shearer is still, that period of time at Blackburn is the best 4 years spell you get of any striker, Henri, Aguero, whoever. For me, that's still the best, even with my 90s bias.
Well, we always have 90s bias, Rob, but yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. It was just every game, it was just Shearer on teletext. Every time you looked at him, Shearer, that was it. And I know it's the same with Haaland now, but I don't get excited about modern football now. So when you're 12, that's your peak. That's your peak football period. So yeah, it's always going to be your heroes from that time. So yeah, if I could have Blackburn Shearer playing for Brighton, I'd be very happy.
Yeah, that'd get you top four definitely. Right, Michael, we're gonna wrap it up there on this sort of trip down the striker memory lane. Thank you for all your contributions and anyone out there who wants to follow some 80s and 90s football, do head over to the place formerly known as Twitter to find out all the stuff from Michael and his account. So again, another little side path away from our season reviews for the 90s decade on These Football Times. If you have enjoyed the podcast, obviously tell us all the things that you think about strikers from the 1990s, maybe the ones that you had in your club banging the goals in during that time, whatever division you were in. But from me and Michael, that's it for now. And we'll be back on with our season reviews on our These Football Times decades, the 1990s.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.